Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The spirit of performance is what defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
This is Full Change with Tom Laidlaw.
Hey, Tom, big event last night for you. You were the center of the attention there at the Ronald McDonald House event.
Well, hold on. Am I not always the center of attention?
No, that... in your life, for sure. Your story, yes.
A fantastic event. The Ronald McDonald House in New York. Obviously, people don't know what it is. It's for families and kids that are going through cancer battles, and they haven't stayed there. They usually can't afford to stay at hotels or whatever, so they stay at the Ronald McDonald House. So it's a great cause. We call it the Scape of the Greats. They've done this dinner for 30 years. They're saying, wow. I don't think the Rangers have been involved for full 30 years. It's like 22 years or something, but... apparently, Rod Gilbert started the involvement of the Rangers in the event. It's a great thing. It's at Chelsea Piers in Manhattan. They obviously have a skate. A lot of guys go out and skate there for them. Alumni guys, they have a scrimmage. And then they have a great dinner after with an auction, interviews all the players. So I've been fortunate. I think it's 4 years in a row now I've been asked to be the MC.
So you're the MC, but let's just go back. So you used to play in this, right?
I never did. I had so I went there 1 year where I was not the MC. No, I think every year I've been there, I've been the MC.
They said, Tom, we want you there, but don't bring your skates. Just come.
Exactly. Skates, huh? So they gave me the job of MC, so I wouldn't skate,
That's it. That was your cut.
It's a blast, though. So it's a great, fantastic event. It's just like 800 people there. They raise close to $900,000 in one night of this event. So, yeah, a lot of big hitters, bankers, Wall Street guys and everything. So they really want to make it a fun event. So they have a script for me to use up there. They allow me to go off script a little bit, so my little smart-ass comment. So,
wait, who's rating you in, though? Is there someone, a production person?
Yeah. There is a guy there, Jerome. Fantastic guy. Does a lot of work to put it together. Really beautiful event. Great food and everything. So when Rod Duguay started dating Sarah Palin, Ron was going to be at this event. This was like 3 years ago or 4 years ago. So I was going to go off script and say something about Sarah Palin. She's a very controversial right-wing person, and this is very liberal. This is very liberal crowd. So I said to Jerome, I said, I'm going to see some funny stuff with Sarah Palin. Looks at me, goes, no, you're not. It's like, because I did. Now I think about it, makes sense.
Producer,
so they let me go. It's pretty cool. So Brian Leach is heavily involved in it too. He couldn't go last night. He had something else going on, but the Henry Lundqvist was there, and
the King, was there.
So I was fortunate because playing with Gretzky, I was used to that level of stardom. And it is really interesting watching people. Henrik's a great guy, but people treat him much different. Like he's got guards around him the whole bit. I was on the stage. I introduced him. So he came up on stage and stood behind me. And then all of a sudden, there's like 100 cameras taking pictures. So, of course, I said, well, geez, everybody's taking a picture of me now. You know, it's just odd coincidence that Henrik's up here. But he's a real gentleman. We've met before, but I don't know if he really knows me at all. And I wouldn't blame him if he didn't. But I'm sitting at the table with Nicky Fatio and his wife. And so Henry comes over very nice. He says, oh, did you play? Now, I thought he meant that I play in the NHL. He was thinking that I play in the game during the day. So I took off my jersey. I says, yeah, Henry, this is me. I played in the NHL. He's very nice. He goes, no. Did you play today?
A good thing he didn't ask you, like, hey, can I get another steak?
Exactly. Yeah, that's true. But a real gentleman. I was up on stage, and this is his first time him doing it. He didn't know how the whole show went, so he came over whispering, do I say something now? And I said, yes, Henrik, you can say something.
Oh, Well, you know, he's got that rock star energy to him. You know, he's like, you could just see it. He's a different level, you know, as
I give it 100%. Yeah. He knows what his brand is, how he carries himself, how he looks, his dress, his hair. You know, I used to kind of laugh at guys like that, but now I really admire that because, like, that's just like every time he's out, like, always on point. Yeah. He's Henrik Lundqvist. He's out.
Look, and listen, we're two heterosexual males here. We can say he's a good looking guy. He's a very good looking guy.
Oh, he's handsome.
He's handsome.
And he does put work into it, but I still think he's like that naturally handsome guy too. And again, you're right. It's like, yeah, the way he carries himself too, that classy kind of guy and everything. So
it's almost like that politician's air, you know, but kind of just genuine. But yeah, you can see the guy's a rock star, man. He really is.
And yeah. So this event, anybody wants to go like next year, you should get tickets for it. And it's a great cause. So they bring in a family that are staying at the house. So they had a girl there, Sonia, and her mother, Maria, I think. They're from Philadelphia, so I was joking around with them about being Flyers fans.
So if you're sick and getting surgery or some procedure in the city, they put the family up for free. No worries about the costs, because sometimes you go to a big city, you know.
Apparently taking care of them with everything, food, diapers if they need them, all that stuff. They were talking about last night. So Sony's this cute 10-year-old girl, and she's got nice hair and a whole bit. So I said, listen, I'm not happy with you. You've got all that hair in your head, and I got nothing up my head. so she was really warming up. She got up and spoke too for a 10-year-old. Okay. Yeah, very cool. They got a little stand to go at the podium there a little bit. And she was not shy. It wasn't like she just said a few words like sheepishly. She was really talking. Her mother at one point was talking about how she's a picky eater. And Sonia turned and looked at the mother with that evil eye, like, what are you saying about me? She was very animated.
I loved it. Yeah. That's great, man. That's what it's all about. That's what you're there for, you know?
Yeah. Great. Everybody has fun. It's, you know, it's somewhat formal, but it's like, you know, there's finger food and everything. But, they really put on a good show, and it's one of those events you go to. You really feel good about being there because it's such a great cause. So, yeah, good.
Wow. So, and just think about it. I mean, if you're as a parent, and I'm a parent, you're a parent. If your kid is sick, that's the worst thing you could go through. You're helpless. You feel horrible. So the fact that they do this and the Rangers are behind it is just that's just awesome.
Yeah, it really is. It's one of those things you're really proud to be part of it. That you've gone to that event. So that was cool.
Yeah, and the MC came through again 4 years in a row.
It's a heavy burden that I have to carry. But, you know, I do it for the people.
Well, you like talking because you have this podcast. You have about 17 Facebook shows you do.
And well, it's funny.
I
know it's funny because you've seen it a couple of times where we have guests on and they're good speakers and they're speaking. Like, I'm just sitting there, I want to talk.
It's okay to listen sometimes, though, Thomas.
There's a reason. There's an old saying, isn't there? There's a reason why I have two ears and one mouth.
Right.
I just haven't figured that out yet.
There's a reason why you have a 4-minute timer set on your phone, too.
I've gone past that a few times. I'm getting a little bit better.
You have. You absolutely have. Yeah. And today we're going to talk with Dave Scatchard from the Islanders, who it's going to be a fascinating interview. I think people love this one.
Yeah, I love these ones where I've never met him before. Watched him as a player, really admired him. He was that like grinder, fighter.
Fought everybody.
Yeah, he always looked like that kind of guy that everybody's wanted to be a teammate with him. Like, yep. That great guy. So I'm looking forward to this, definitely.
Yes, this will be a good one. So enjoy Full Change Podcast today with Dave Scatchard. Tom, I love these shows. We have an Islander on today. He played on more than just the Islanders, but he's known as an Islander. He's a really well-liked teammate, someone that everybody loved wherever he went. He's got a book out called The Comeback, and today we have he's got some famous friends too, Tony Robbins among them. So today we have on number 38, Dave Scatchard.
You had to start with the Islander thing though, right? You start with the Islanders right off the bat, right? Stir the pot.
You have to.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on your show, and Tom, I've been a fan of yours when you played, and then surprisingly, I'm a massive Survivor fan. I told my wife yesterday, it was hilarious because we always joke around about me applying, and I said, you know what, like the last couple Survivors, people quit early, and I'm just like, you know what, that's a joke, like put me on that show, I'll go till my legs fall off, my teeth will be missing, like put me on show, and I'm like, I'm making a video.
So you should. Did you make a video?
I did. I made a casting video. And I said, listen, guys, I said, I love the show, but some of these people you guys are casting, they're kind of soft and they're just quitting on you guys. And I said, put some strong masculine in there. Let me go. Let me run it.
Nice. See, that's what they want too. They want people with the personality like that too. They're going to step up.
Yeah. Listen, Tom, I've had dreams constantly about being on this show. And it's like, I can't turn it off. My wife's like, I don't want you going on that show. And I'm like, listen, I don't know why I'm supposed to be on the show. I'm like, I do whatever it takes. I actually said 3 back-to-back videos, all different. Like, you know, and I'm like, screw it. If they pick me, they pick me. If they don't, then it's not meant to be.
What they want. They want people with personality like that. They want people that won't quit either. Yeah, like as far as applying, we had one girl on our show, Chelsea. They called her the stalker because she sent in like, you know, 20 videos. And she got the personal emails and all that kind of stuff. Well, listen, after the show's done, I'll contact the casting director.
That would be amazing. I finished sending it in and you guys called me the next day. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is weird. Maybe there's a connection there. Maybe you could help me out. I don't know.
Okay. We will definitely. Yeah. So did you analyze my game? How did I do?
Wait, hold on. Did you analyze his guest spot? He was a guest spot on Survivor.
All right, start the show. He's so smart and he's such a good guy and like so nice. It was almost like, I hate to say it, but like nice guys seem to finish last on that show where you got to slit some throats. And like, I'm the same way as you, Tom. I'm the nicest guy. I don't lie. I don't cheat. I don't steal.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there's a way that I could play like that, but, you know, just watching what's happened all the other seasons, like it seems like very rarely does the nice guy make it through to the finish line. And you were just polite. You were kind. You're a good guy. Like, how do you get voted off? I was so mad. I'm like, we got one good guy on here. They vote him off.
And then they sent all the tribal council too. They said all this nice stuff about me. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm gone. Yeah, they said what a great guy I was. Yeah. So that was a blast. Okay, we'll do that though. We'll get the casting director and get you. I'd love to see you.
That'd be great. How was your experience on it? Did you enjoy it or was it a pain?
Oh, I loved it. It was, I do a lot of motivational speaking now. So I say to people, if there's something you want to do in your life, don't make excuses and say, I'll do it tomorrow, I'll do it next year. You know, be like you, go after it. And so, and it's, I think when we go to LA for casting for 5 days and you meet all the CBS people and the Survivor people. And I told them the same thing as you. I said, I won't cheat. I won't lie. I'm not going to be crying up there. But you know, I'm going to, you know, do it. And there's a lot of stuff behind, especially because I get voted out fairly early. There's a lot of stuff behind the scenes they don't show. Like we had a blind side, the first vote. And I was the one to put the blind side together. But again, like, you know, I was trying to be just quiet and calm a little bit. So yeah, but it was a blast. You'll love it. Yeah. I'll tell you, when they dropped you off at Fiji, and you start playing, you're going, I can't believe I'm playing. This is like the coolest thing, right? So it was good.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Well, I'm proud of you, man. Proud of you for doing it.
Hinton, Alberta is where you're from.
Yeah, the armpit of Alberta. You know, it smells like a pulp mill. sorry to everyone in Hinton, but it does. The pulp mill is in the valley, and we lived on the hill, and that smoke just rises up, and the whole town kind of smells. And it's a coal mining town. My dad was a coal miner. My mom was a bank teller before she had us, and then she became a stay-at-home mom. At 12, I moved down to Salmon Arm, British Columbia, which is near Kelowna and a few hours from Vancouver. And then at 15, I left home to go play, 15, 16, left home to go play junior. I was trying to make the Winter Hawks in the Western League, and I got cut. Ended up having to stay a year, and their sort of farm team was Junior A, Tier 2 in Kimberley for the Kimberley Dynamiters. Next year, I was kind of the last cut with the Portland Winterhawks. And, you know, I got some crazy stories on how that all went down, if you want them. But
yeah, let's roll.
Yeah, man. Well, I mean, I was a borderline guy. I scored a ton of goals in minor hockey. And, as you go up, your role sort of changes. And Wayne Weimer was Jason Weimer's dad. He was the Kimberley Dynamiter coach. And he older teams, 20-year-old players. I'm the 60-year-old skinny kid. And I wasn't physical and I didn't really fight. And then in order to get ice time, I kind of had to start doing that. And I won my first couple fights. And then, once I kind of got my confidence, I started scoring. But those guys made it hard on me. You were allowed to carry as many 20-year-olds as you wanted. So, like, he wanted to win. He just stacked the team with 20-year-olds. Then there's, 16-year-olds. And, like, it wasn't a nice introduction to junior boring. Right. But I had a couple of guys that took care of me. Next year, I barely make Portland. And I remember this is sort of a teaching moment. And I also speak from stages. And, you know, this is a story that I tell. But I remember I sat out the first game in the Western League. And we had a few, like, 5 extra players. And they're trying to figure out who was going to make the team. And I sat out the game against Seattle. The next day, we play Seattle back in Portland. And there's 5 of us. Practice, morning skate ends. But as the team leaves, Mike Williamson, the assistant coach, comes on the ice, and he's like, "All right, boys, we're skating." Like, all right, I'm pissed that I'm not in lineup again, and I'm literally just like, I just had so much rage and anger that I couldn't get in this lineup. But I was in excellent shape. I trained my butt off all summer long, and we start bag skating, and we're bag skating. And I remember after the first two or three, you know, end to ends or line rushes or whatever we were doing, one of the guys like, "Hey, slow it down here, Skip. We got to pace ourselves. We all got to look good and all this stuff. And I want to fit in on this team too." But something in me told me like, "No, you go, Dave. Like, just go." And they're sucking wind, and I'm doing fine. And then I do a couple more, and they're kind of staring me down. And then a couple of guys start swearing at me because I'm kind of making them look bad a little bit. And I'm like, "Well, it's kind of past the point of no return now. I'm just going to put the hammer down." Yeah. And I started lapping guys. I was like end to end, side to side, boards to boards. It was the hardest bag skate I've ever done in my whole career. And guys are puking. We're going over to the bench. I puke. I go back, get on the line again, go. And I remember at the very end, we were out there. We had morning skate for almost an hour. And then the bag skate was like close to an hour and no pucks.
Ooh.
And it was
brutal.
So at the end, almost every guy puked that skate. It was the hardest skate. It was kind of like the scene from Miracle, yeah. You know, where Brooks beat the guys.
Yeah.
And I'm on the goal line and I'm literally, almost like your lungs are bleeding. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, "Man, I don't know if I can. Go another one." And they blow the whistle. That was it. So everyone takes off their helmets. We're laying on the ice and steam's like coming up off our heads. And I'm like, "Holy shit, that was a hard, hard skate." And guys start to make their way off and they're cursing under their breath and everything. And Willie comes over, the coach, and he goes, "Hey, Sketch, unbelievable job today." He's like, "Congrats, you made the team.
Oh,
and you're going tonight." I'm like, "What? I got to play now."
I can't
even play. So, but what I didn't know, and this is the thing, is like you do the things properly, even when you think no one's watching. All the scouts, all the management, all the brass, they were up in the nosebleeds at the Rose Garden, this big stadium that we played in. And you couldn't see. You didn't know that everybody was watching. And it was a test. And they wanted to see quit and who wouldn't. And
I love that story. That's cool.
Great. The next day, three guys gone off the team and back to Canada, never to be heard of ever again. I never saw them play anymore. But those little tipping points, Tom, as you know, they're the difference makers. They're the difference makers. When I was 16 and I was homesick, I remember calling home, I'm like, "Mom, I'm like, all these guys are older than me. They're all drinking. Like I don't really fit in. They're kind of being hard on me. They won't give up any ice time. I can't get on the power play. Like, I'm not having fun. Like, can I come home?" My mom's like, "Listen, your bed's here. Your brother and sister miss you, all this stuff. But like, I think you're going to regret it, Dave. This is the thing that you wanted your whole life. And you said you'd do whatever it took to get it. And now this is like the first time in your life where you're not the star." And, you know, she goes, "You can come home. Your bed's still here. Me and your dad miss you. But I think you should think about it for a night." And I thought about it the next day and I'm like, "You know what, man? They're not going to stop me. I'm like, I'm going to work so hard that there's no way they can stop me. There's no way I won't make the team. There's no way they can't play me. If I just bust my ass so hard and I'm the hardest working guy and I'm the first guy at the rink, last guy to leave, literally just, I'm not as skilled as some of these older players, but like I can figure that out and I'll shoot extra pucks." And like I made a promise to myself, about all these things that I was going to do. And I kept it, Tom. And
that's a big moment.
You get emotional, but like, it's like,
yeah, go.
If I would have quit, and like none of this. I'm sitting in a 10,000 square foot house in Scottsdale, Arizona. I have everything that I could ever want in my life. I get to teach and help other people now and share my stories on what it takes and that sort of pro mentality to like go to the next level. And it's like, there's all these points where I saw other guys just, it feels like it's too much and you want to quit. And then you got to fucking push one more time and then one more time and one more time. And it never gets easy. We're always pushing, right? But it's like when you start to make that the way that you are, that's how you operate. And then somehow you figure out a way to win. And it's like,
don't you think a lot of it is your background growing up, what you did, your father being the iron guy and all that working?
Yeah, man. My dad in the coal mines, like my dad started off as a PE teacher and the money wasn't very good. And he went into coal mining and money still wasn't very good. We didn't grow up with a lot. But, you know, I would skate on the outdoor rinks. I would carry my, I would walk through the snow drifts. I would carry my skates. I'd pack my net on my head and walk like a couple miles down to the rink. And my dad would get off late from work and he'd have his lights shining on the outdoor rink. And I'd just be out there, this little guy just shooting pucks in the snow. And like, I didn't realize it, but I was building this resiliency. I was building this like strength. And then I'm like, I'm going to quit now. Like, I don't quit. And the coolest thing about my dad was I would say the craziest things, like, Dad, I wonder if I could swim across that lake. And he's like, only one way to find out. And like, I would do stupid stuff like that. And my dad never told me like, hey, that's impossible. You're not going to do it. He'd be like, yeah, go for it. My dad grew up hang gliding and barefoot water skiing, motorcycling. So he's kind of an adrenaline junkie, but his belief in people and their capacity to do way more than they believe, I believe that's where I get it from. And when he passed away recently, I made a promise to him that I'd try to carry on his legacy. And that's sort of why I built this coaching business, is my dad was the ultimate Mr. Positive, and he would believe more in you than you would believe in your own dream. And that sometimes is what you need when times get tough.
Listen, it seems like you and I grew up in the same house. My parents, same. They're farm boy. My dad was a farm boy, became a firefighter. And it's the same thing. One of the biggest gifts they ever gave me, they never took away my dream. So it sounds like the same with you, right? It's like,
yeah, I can't listen to you. I grew up on a farm too. Yeah, my dad was a farm too. Mm-hmm.
Listen to me, see, like, I look back, like, same as you, I'm writing a book right now. So it's really forced me to look back at those things and realize, like, I don't think I appreciated my father enough until I started looking back and said, I would not have become what I did. And now, if it wasn't for him and my grandfather. That's cool.
Yeah, as you know, in my book, The Comeback, My Journey Through Heaven and Hell, I didn't mean to talk so much about my dad, but his influence on me was so big that it rippled through everything that I have done and will do and am doing now. He is in me. He's still living around me. I feel him. And, you know, I miss him every day. He's my kind of idol, but, you know, a good man. For sure.
Isn't it just amazing too, as you get older, and it's sad being in some ways, after you lose them, you reflect more and you go, man, what a great father he was. So let's talk about the book then. We want to talk about your hockey, obviously, too. The title of the book is, again, what?
The Comeback, My Journey Through Heaven and Hell. And, you know, Tom, it's kind of a crazy story, and I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but it's not just a comeback. In my career, there's another comeback that sort of happens, and it defies logic. It defies anything that I grew up with or raised with, and you know, it's kind of a surprise twist in the book that happens. But I had some crazy stuff happen to me, and when I left the game, you know, we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves. But when I left the game, I was really bad shape. My brain didn't work. I had microhemorrhaging in my brain, so my cognitive function was very, very limited. I dragged my leg when I walked. I slurred my speech. I was just disabled, and I spent 3 years at the Mayo Clinic, 3 days a week. And you know, at the end of it, they just said, "I'm sorry. We've done everything we can for you. This is just how you're going to be." And I was like, "What? I'm 36 years old. Like, I can't even hold my kid right now. I can't push him on the swing set without throwing up because the motion messes me up. I can't be out in the sunlight. I can't be in loud places." I was drinking myself to sleep because the pain in my head was so bad. And I'm like, you guys are the smartest doctors in the world. Like, if you're not going to help me, what do I do? And it got really dark. And there was kind of a point where I yelled at God, and I said, "I know you're real. I saw you. That's part of the surprise of the book. Why are you punishing me? You know, what's going on?" And I was gonna check out because I couldn't function. I felt like it was a burden to my wife, to everyone. Kind of felt sorry for me, and they had to take care of me, and like I was just the shell of a human, and I was kind of desperate and hopeless. I ended up doing some stuff where I hired a life coach. I had 6 properties in 3 countries. I was really good at real estate when I was playing, and I couldn't read a real estate contract after my injuries. And I'm like, I don't even know what's going on right now. I better hire somebody to watch my back and make sure I don't screw up everything that I just built. And I hired a coach, and we started sort of consolidating everything to make my life simpler so I could manage it. And then he said, if you ever get better, what would you like to do? And I said, I'd really like to help people. I said, I'd like to help kids. I'd like to help people that are struggling like I am right now. And I'd like to help athletes make it to the top. And he said, I think you should go do Tony's. And this is a Tony Robbins coach, but I'd never done any Tony stuff really. And but I just hired this coach to help me. Anyways, long story short, end up going to this leadership academy. And on the way there, I'm literally bartering with God. And I'm like, listen, I need a miracle. Because if this doesn't work, I'm out of here. And I drive to San Diego, which is a big deal for me with my head. I had to pull over to sleep twice because it was stressful for the 5-hour drive. I get in there. There's all this loud music and people dancing around. And I'm like, what the? I leave and I'm crying on the sidewalk because I can't even be in the room. And Scott Humphreys, Tony's brother-in-law, was selling these Platinum Partner memberships. And he comes out. He's like, Dave Scatchard, right? I'm like, yeah. He's like, hey, I'm from Vancouver. I'm a big fan. You know, is this your first event? I'm like, yeah. He goes, listen, what's going on? I just said, listen, I can't handle this. And he goes, well, you're not in the back guy. You're a front row guy. So I'm going to give you front row seats for this whole thing and put you with the Platinum Partners for all these really successful people who are trying to get to the next level. Anyways, long story short, I have a couple of miracles happen there. And I actually have some healing that happens when I was doing this psychology technique called the swish pattern. And I felt something pop behind my eye and my whole face starts to go purple. And my trainer comes running over because it looks like I'm having a freaking aneurysm. And he's like, are you okay? Yeah, man, like something released. And over the next couple of days, I talk about it a lot in the book, but over the next couple of days, a couple of other miracles happened where I literally knew I was going to heal. And it was like, wow. And I said, if I can get, and the funny thing is, Tony doesn't even teach it. Tony doesn't even show up. I was so mad. I go there to see Tony Robbins. He doesn't even teach it. So I said, wow, whatever this guy's doing, if he's not even here and I got these results, what would happen if I went and invested $100,000 to go do this thing? So I did that, a Platinum Partner. I toured around the world for 2 years chasing Tony everywhere he went, and I could do every event included in that, and plus some private stuff. And then he would introduce me to other people, energy workers and shaman and monks and healers. And I was just like stroking checks. Tom, I spent over $1 million learning from all of these weirdos all over the world and trying to get them to work on me and work on my energy and my head and my brain. And I took little gold nuggets from each of them and their practices, and the light started to come back on, man. I tried everything. I became a vegan for a while. I literally changed everything about my life and my mindset, and the light started to come back on. And I started showing other people how to do it. And what I realized was I gathered all this stuff over the last 2, 3, 4 years of training with these people that was just in me. And when people would step into my office, and at first I started with athletes, then I went to entrepreneurs, but now I coach like all kinds of people. But the funny thing is, when I don't have an answer, it just sort of like comes, and it's one of the things of the fabric that made this man. Like I had to rebuild this guy because the other guy wasn't going to make it. And I'm just grateful, man. I'm grateful to God. I have miracles. I'm grateful to Tony. I'm grateful to all these amazing people that helped me. But I'm through it now. And that was, you know, the injury happened 11, 12 years ago, but it took probably 4 years to get my feet back under me where I could function. Like,
see, I didn't realize that at all, that you got through that. Wow, that's incredible. Do you know Riley Cote?
Yeah. Yeah.
You ever talked to him?
No, I haven't talked to Riley. He's doing some, is he into the like psilocybin and stuff like
that? Yeah. But a lot of the same beliefs about life that you have, like mm-hmm. very spiritual and everything. We had him on a show. He was fantastic. Just like you. Listening to the stories about the things he cool. gone through and how he healed himself. So we'll put you guys together. I think you guys enjoy talking to each other.
Yeah, amazing. And you know, one of my goals this year is to get a podcast going. And I've got this beautiful collection. I was filming this thing called Hockey Star Secrets. And I went around the NHL and filmed mostly like guys that were leaving the game, JR and all these guys. But I had 24 interviews packaged. I was trying to sell it to Netflix and they didn't want it. They said it was too positive. so they wanted Tiger King and stuff, you know. So yeah. I've got all this stuff, and I'd like to package it and release it probably as a pod, but the business has been going so nuts that I haven't had a chance to, but I almost need to just hire somebody and have them.
There are some things that are too good to keep a secret, like how your Amex Platinum card helps you have the perfect trip. I'd like to check into the Centurion Lounge. Or how it seems like you always get those hard-to-snag tables.
Ooh, yum.
And how you get the most out of select can't-miss events. With access to the Centurion Lounge, Resi Priority Notify, and Amex card member benefits at select events, you'll have to share. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Yeah, we've done what? How many shows have we done now? Tom's like 90 shows?
Just about 100 now, yeah.
100 shows? It's amazing some of the stories. Like your story right now was just fantastic. I didn't know you'd gone through that stuff at all. We've had a few guys, and they're very open talking about it too. A lot of guys tried to commit suicide, like Malarchuk and Richie Pilon. And had a former teammate of mine, Mike Allison, who's a great guy. And I had a great relationship with Herb Brooks. And Mike started talking about how he contemplated suicide because of Herb Brooks. And,
wow.
You know, yeah, it's really a unique view now looking back at the game. Tom's a big hockey fan. And after the first probably 20, less than that, he turned and looked at me like, wow, you guys are messed up. Like the stuff we go through to play, I'm sure you feel the same way. It's great.
You know what? It's kind of a weird thing. And this is sort of one of the revelations that came to me was like for me to go fight, and not, I wasn't a heavyweight, but like I'd fight anybody and I was kind of middleweight and I kind of got put into that role, but that's not my nature. Yeah. And I kind of had to, I started visualizing like how many times I'd put on armor. Like the first time my dad spanked me, the first time a girl broke my heart, the first time I got cheated on, the first time that I got lied to, the first time I got taken advantage of, the first time I had to go fight. And the little shell, like David, the little angel kid, he got buried under a lot of layers of armor.
Yeah.
And it didn't have, I didn't start to heal truly until I removed a lot of those layers and I got back to like my authentic soul. And, you know, it's funny for me to be talking this way because I didn't grow up within the church or religion or spirituality, none of it, but it found me and it was part of my healing journey. So I talk about it openly now. And like, I think we're like soldiers, like these kids off the farm that go off and fight and kill people in other countries and stuff. Like that's not normal human behavior. So they have to shut it off. Otherwise it hurts like too much. They can't, they couldn't do that job if they let themselves really feel. So then eventually you just shut off like your essence really. And I could run through a wall, Tom. I could run through a wall. I could fight anybody. I could play through broken bones, missing teeth, broken, whatever. But I couldn't really feel anything.
Yeah, I know.
And it's messed up. And like, I love the game. And I don't know if I could have played the other way. Maybe I could have. And like, listen, there's pieces of that armor that are super valuable. Discipline, focus, commitment, determination, relentlessness, resiliency. All those things are amazing. But there's also some pieces that I would take out of that now if I were to do it again. And I would try to stay authentically me and actually be able to communicate if I'm or if I'm scared or if I'm, you know.
I know. I hear you, but that was such a – I hear you and I agree 100%. But I remember back playing how I felt about playing. I wasn't going to tell anybody my feelings.
Right? I know. Me neither. You don't want to seem like a birdie. You don't want to see a crybaby. You don't want to see – and my dad, like – farm boy, like, hey, like, you know, don't, boys don't cry, like, okay, I'll never cry, you know. You know, don't be a pussy, like, all these things, right? And it's like, I love my dad was extremely hard on me, but he was fair. But I have a standard of excellence and belief about how, you know, how you're supposed to treat people. And I think that those are all wonderful things, but also like there's certain things that I'm like, man, looking back on it, I don't know if that was good for me or bad for me. It created the man now. You same thing with you. Like, that's why you're so special. You do have that ability to go hard and go deep if you want to. But also, I think like doing the show actually probably gives you a little bit of flexibility to really show your other side.
Yeah. And like you, I didn't want anybody to see the other side before.
Right. I know.
I probably didn't even know it was there, to be honest with you. Right. It's just like,
me too.
I forgot. We're still waiting, Dave. We're still waiting for Tom to show us.
Well, you know, I really admire. I look back at my life, everything in my life. I've made so many mistakes, tons of mistakes. And people say, well, you learn from mistakes. I don't know if I've learned from mistakes. What I learned was, what do you call it, Tom? I just plow forward. I just plow through it. I watched an old video of us playing. We were early in the 80s, we're playing the LA Kings. I'm carrying the puck up the ice. I go to pass with one of my teammates. The puck like explodes like a grenade. So I didn't hesitate at all. Went to the other team's guy. I just ran over the other guy right away. This is my first reaction. I'm sure you're the same way, right? It's just mistakes are going to happen and you learn, oh, I got to go fight through it. So that's a fantastic story. Go ahead.
I agree with you. But then also, like, there's these times, like, okay, I got like two things. So, like, the one, when I went to God and said, why are you punishing me? And then I went through those experiences, I was brushing my teeth in the mirror and God started talking back to me. This is after the event. And he goes, I wasn't punishing you. I was training you. Because the people that are going to come to you in your life are going to be hopeless, are going to be desperate, are going to be injured, are going to be scared, are going to be depressed. And I didn't know that. Like, I was just like, when I went to the NHL, similar to you, I didn't play much in the minors. I just went like, I'm in the NHL and I'm playing, I'm rocking it, I'm flying, I'm not thinking about anything and da-da-da. And then when it crashes down and I can't even speak and I'm like, what's going on? Why? I'm like a Lamborghini that's been a car accident, nobody's fixing me. And then they leave me on the side of the road and say, well, that's just how you're going to be. I'm like, what? And I wouldn't have compassion for people. I wouldn't have patience. Yeah. I wouldn't have the understanding when people come to me in pain and go, listen, brother, I get it. I've been there. I've been exactly where you are. And I know what that feels like. Here's a few things that maybe help me. I don't know if it'll help you, but let's try them. And I was being trained. Same thing now. There's weird matrixy stuff going on. It's like, you know, why is this happening? But if I can shift my perspective, I'm being trained. This will be valuable. I'll be able to help other people through this stuff. And just like my injury, I could say, which many guys do, why did this happen to me? I'm so unlucky. I'd still be playing in the NHL. I had millions of more dollars. Like, I'm so, why me? I could have said that. Or the doctors told me I'm permanently disabled. I could have owned that label. I refused to. Now I look back on it and said, thank you, God, for that injury. Why? Because I had 25,000 people come through my program that I've helped. And I would never have explored the world. I would never understand all these different things and cultures and beliefs and be open to it if I didn't have the injury. The injury is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. Yeah.
So perspective shifts can absolutely change things and a dime for people. It's just beautiful because I've seen it happen. And when you see somebody shift the perspective, it shifts everything instantly. And it's like, wow. And you choose to live another life.
Yeah.
Totally. Get away from that hockey life, right? Like we talked before, the hockey life is great, but there's so many guys, and I feel bad because they're still stuck in that hockey world, thinking the same way.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I don't know how to call it, like it frees you when you finally get away and say, I'm not a hockey player anymore. I love playing. It's done. I'm a human being with a lot to offer. Now, did you have a relationship with God before he spoke to you?
When I was young, I always spoke to God. And then one day my dad heard me, and my parents weren't atheists, but they just didn't go to church. My dad's like, who are you talking to? I'm like, God. And he's like, what's God saying? And I'm like, he's saying this. And I keep talking to myself, and my dad's like, hey, stop talking to yourself. Like, that's ridiculous. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I like turned it off. But I would always, my friends would go to, like, in Alberta, we didn't have big churches like in the States, but like my friends went to Awanus, which is like this little young kids church camp thing. Whatever. And I would go out of curiosity, but I would always speak. And then like, I would be afraid to verbalize it or own it. And then like, I'd forget about it. And then when something bad happened to me, I'd pray my ass off and be like, okay, God, I promise if these four ankle surgeries that I have right before training camp, if you could fix those, even though I have played hockey for a year and get me on that Vancouver Canucks team, I will do whatever I can. And frickin', it would,
everything I ever prayed for, I got. And, you know, that's another funny story is, like, I played a little bit in the minors, 20-something games, and then they found holes in my heels. And after my draft, I was drafted in second round. Actually, that's a whole nother story. But
drafted, we're going to have to do a few shows with you. Right. Not going to be enough.
Right. So they find these holes in my heels, and they're like, dude, you have eggshells in your heels. They'll shatter at any moment. We got to get you to Vancouver. We got to figure out how to fix this. So I go to Vancouver. They're like, we've never seen anything like this. This is like one in a million. I'm like, oh, great. So they take bone off my hip. They stick it in one of my feet. They find out that it's in both my feet. So they got to do it again. So they do the surgery over again. This is like in December, January. They take more bone off my hip. Still not enough. So they do another surgery. They take donor bone, a whole lady's pelvis. They grind it up. That's why I'm touching my feminine side. Fill in the holes. It's like cement. They fill in the holes. And like, okay, finally I can like start work. Like I'm doing upper body. I remember I bench pressed 225, 31 times at training camp.
Nice.
I had crazy numbers, but my legs were like this. So anyways, I couldn't skate. And then I'm living at the Rosedale and Robson Street. The bellman's bringing me my food. I got to crawl on my hands and knees to go to the bathroom. Like I was just, it was the worst time of my life. I was completely alone. I wasn't part of the Canucks. I wasn't part of the Syracuse Crunch. I'm sitting in the hyperbaric chamber every day. I think that did speed up my healing. And I'm just about to get ready to like start skating again. This is like maybe like June. And they did an x-ray and they're like, oh my God, Dave, the right one, we got to do over again. We only got half of it. And I'm like, come on. So I'm like, there's no way I'm playing hockey this year. Or never mind making the Canucks. And they drill into my foot, they do the thing, and I got one leg. I'm doing one leg extensions, I'm doing one legged squats, my left leg, like whatever I could do to try to build my body. I go into training camp and Ron Gilarm goes, he was the scout, and I said, Ronnie, I go, do I have a chance of making this team? He goes, listen, we got Messier, Bure, Linden, McGillney, Jelena, like we got like a stacked team, but we need some guys to get them on the power play. So if you can run around, smoke guys, protect these guys, fight for them, cause chaos out there and kill penalties and block shots and win faceoffs, you might have a shot. I go, So I go, you point them out and I'll go knock them down. My first training camp, I absolutely just almost kill Pavel Bure. The best hit I've ever done in my life. And Pavel never got hit. And he's going Mach 10 this way. I'm on the other team. We're Mach 10 this way. I hit him. You know when those hits where you don't feel anything? And he went right through my legs and he's on his back like this. We're in Whistler. Training camp, and the whole crowd is like silent. They're like, oh my God. And he's not moving. Gino comes over to me, and I'm like, all right, I'm fighting Gino for sure.
Oh,
and he's like, hey, you can't hit Pavel like that. And I'm like, so sorry. I didn't think I could. So anyways, Pavel gets up. He's okay. Next morning, I wake up. Pat Quinn comes up to me. He goes, get over here, kid. He goes, hey, I've never seen him get hit like that. That's amazing. Like, he's like, get me that close. He's like,
there you go.
You're centering him and Gino today.
Oh,
line over, and I was their centerman. And then I got a hat trick. So actually, wait, I got two goals in the inter-squad game. And then a guy's skate cuts my wrist. So I'm like, oh, I gotta get sewed up. So I'm getting sewed up by Mike Bernstein. Bernie goes, hey, like, just take your time. It's training camp. You don't have to go back out there. I'm like, no, Bernie, I got a chance for a hat trick. He's like, are you serious?
McGillie's laughing. He's like, young kids, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm getting back out there. I go get the hat trick. And now, like, I'm actually, like, kind of got a shot, you know? And next thing you know, I'm on a plane to Japan. That's our first NHL game. And Messi is my roommate. And I'm like, I looked up to Messi my whole life. We hit in Alberta, you know? And Messi is my roommate, and he kind of was like mentoring me. And that was the first game ever outside the U.S. And that was when Paul Kariya was trying to sign his deal. So they thought they'd have him in Japan and Canucks versus Anaheim. And we played the Yoyogi Arena, which is a high diving stadium, a swimming stadium. So there, we put the rink over top of a swimming pool. There are high diving boards behind the nets, and the crowd didn't know who to cheer for. They just cheered for like anybody. So, anyways, it's a great way to. Oh, and I same thing, man. I was a healthy scratch the first game. I'm like, ah, shoot. And we're carrying extra players, and I'm like, I might not make it. You know, like I was on that pool. And Mike Sillinger is screwing around in practice with Archer Zerbe after practice. And his skate cuts Silly's calf, like, pretty bad. So then I'm just minding my own business. And one of the coaches comes over. He goes, hey, bud, you're going tonight. And I'm like, what?
And I'm like, ah. Remember walking into the dressing room and I see number 20 Scatcherd hanging
out. So that's your first NHL game?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So nice. I tell my parents if I ever make it, I'm flying them to wherever I am. But then it was in Japan, so I bought them a big screen. So my mom's taking pictures of the TV for my first shift. And I'm skating on the ice and I'm like, holy shit. All those bag skates, all those fights, all those weightlifting, all the training, all the being scared. It was all worth it, man. Like, I made it. And nobody can ever say that I never played. Like, all my doubters, all my haters, like, I just made it. I literally was, tears were coming down as I'm skating in front of
them. That's an incredible, that first game is unbelievable, isn't it? Because you think,
no, like, yours, yeah, I want to hear yours.
Well,
oh, here we go. Here we go.
Well, Tom's heard this story many times. So at training camp, at Phil Esposito, was similar to you. Phil Esposito was still playing. And remember back then, guys, the old guys didn't come to camp in shape. They'd done nothing all summer long. So we had a long camp twice a day. But I knew if I had made the same as you, I had to be in great shape. I was in fantastic shape, running hills, lifting weights.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we come into camp. We have a scrimmage fight 3 or 4 days into it. And Phil Esposito is carrying the puck through the neutral zone. And he loses the puck. He looks down at his feet. And my job was to hit people. Didn't matter who it was. So I stepped into Phil, knocked him right up his ass too. And he is hot though. And like you, the whole building goes quiet, like when you hit Burry. And I'm thinking to myself, what did I do? I just hit Phil Esposito. And he gets up and he's screaming at me and everything. And everybody else is just standing there watching it. And scrimmage finishes. We go in the locker room. Things got to settle down. Phil gets up, starts walking towards me. I think, am I going to have to fight Phil Esposito in the locker room? Yeah. Yeah. And like you, he comes over, he says, you really want to make this team, don't you? I said, Phil, I dreamed my whole life of playing the National Hockey League. So he says, okay, don't hit me again, but I really respect that. So I said, okay, that's fine. I had a great camp. I was in the lineup opening night. We played in Boston back when they had Terry O'Reilly and John Hasek and all those guys. And I was supposed to be a big, tough, strong guy. And I'm thinking, oh my God, like I'm happy I'm here, but what have I got myself into? So I was so nervous. First period, John Davidson's in net. I've got the puck on the left side of the net, and I'm trying to shoot it behind, get it to the other side, shoot behind the net. So I hit JD in the back of the leg and shot it in my own net.
The first game?
First period.
They didn't get him the puck for that one.
Oh, God. So you go back to the bench, and it's not a teachable moment, so it's not like the coach is going to come back to you and say, Tom, okay, maybe you do this instead of that. It's like they're looking at you, what kind of an idiot are you? And Freddie Shiro was still coaching. So our second game was in Toronto. We survived the first night, still play. Second night, we're in Toronto. I mean, my hometown. My parents were at the game. Maple Leaf Gardens, Daryl Sittler, the whole bit. And so now I'm thinking to myself, Freddie Shiro had told myself, Chris Katsopoulos and Eddie Hosmer, that he basically wants us to fight. You know, we're big, tough, strong guys. So I'm going by the bench, and Robert Picard butt-ended me. You know that kind of butt-end play where he's really not trying to hurt you. He's really more trying to hook you up. So he knocks me down and the bench goes nuts. And I'm thinking, I just flashed in my head. I'm thinking, okay, I've dreamed my whole life. I shot the puck in my own net last night. Freddie Shiro's on the bench. I've got to do something here. So poor Robert Picard, and we had him on the show too. I just stood up and suckered him, right? I gave him a left. I came right up off the ice, sucking him, knocked him down. And funny, Daryl Sittler comes skating over to me. And I'm thinking to myself, I got to get his autograph. Like, this is Daryl Sittler. That's what was going on in my head. And I realized I'm in the National Hockey League. I got to do something about it. So the FU bombs are flying back and forth. And it's funny. I had a good game. Then after the game, they told me to get a place. I'd made the team. So it was
amazing.
Amazing. My poor mother was at the game. She was mortified too. Like, her son goes knock this guy out at center ice at Maple Leaf Gardens. My father, you know, the father's a proud father.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We the same family, it sounds like, for sure.
Yeah, I know. That's true, right? Yeah, my mother was more the one, she was tough. She wouldn't let me, like, if I ever tried to back down from something, she said, you're not backing down from anything. You're also, same stuff. So how long did you play for Vancouver?
97 to basically 2000. And I was involved in a trade with me, Bill McCault, and Kevin Weeks for Felix Potvin. So to the Islanders. And we went from there, and, we were at Ed Jovanovski's Christmas party in the basement, and it was, I had asked for a trade. Mark Crawford took over and hated me. He just wouldn't play me. He's healthy scratching me. And Brian Burke was the GM. And he's like, Scatch. He goes, I don't know. This guy just, he's got it. He gave me a list of five guys when he got here that he didn't want on the team. And you were one of them. And he's like, I told him, you're going to love Scatch. He'll do whatever you tell him to do. He'll play his ass off. And he said, no, he's not going to be part of it. So I had to ask for a trade, but I asked, just let me get through Christmas. I was in Vancouver. My mom and dad lived in Salmon Arm. I just want to go home, see him for a couple of days, and then wherever I go, I go. And I got traded, the deadline day, like the date, like a day before the last day before Christmas break to Long Island. And there's a whole funny story they put in the book about the trade part, but we get to New York and nobody picks us up. We don't have anybody's phone number. We left to a media storm in Vancouver with like 20 cameras. So we all put on our suits and ties, me, Mucky, and Weeksy. And we walk out and like, there's no media, like nobody even cares that we're there. So we're like LaGuardia, we're sitting there and we don't know, there's no vehicle, there's no guy with an Islander
sign.
They, wow. The team's in bankruptcy. They don't know who owns, the league owns the team. Milbury's been drinking. I can tell when we finally get a hold of him. And he's like, oh yeah, just get a limo and bring me the bill. So Weeks has got his goalie pads, all his goalie equipment. I got all my hockey equipment. Mucky's got all his hockey equipment, plus all our like luggage. Right. And we get this white, it's like out of a bad movie, this long white limo, and we're just gonna packed. So it's all packed, and three of us are on the back bench, and we drive up to McDonald's because we're starving. We just order like everything out of the menu. So we're just picking out. We roll up to the Long Island Marriott, which is a total dump. And that was where I lived for the next 4 or 5 months. And I got there and Milbury's like, hey, I've never said this to a player before, but we're almost mathematically eliminated before Christmas from playoffs. So he goes, you were one of the keys of the trade. Like, I really wanted you. I love you as a player. But if you play your ass off, like, I'm kind of giving you a green light to go to the city and hang out if you want. You're never going to have another one. I can't trade for anybody. I can't sign any free agents. Like, we're like screwed. We have to wait for the league. So like, I'm like, oh, what? Okay. And I remember the first game where like, it was just the culture was not good when I got there, and everyone's all down to the dumps and stuff. And like, we were playing Pittsburgh, I think. And it's my first game there. And it sort of seemed that way my whole career. When I played for a new team, I'd fight the first day just to kind of like set the tone. And I didn't go out there thinking that. But like, we're down 4-2 and guys are kind of packing it in. Like, no. There's still plenty of game left. I went and grabbed this kid and I'm like, hey, he was up in the minors. I'm like, you want to go? And he's like, absolutely. And I won, like, didn't really one punch him, but I killed him. And I'm looking at my bench like, F you. Like, oh, playing. We're not done yet. Like, we're not packing it in. And I go to the bench. One of the trainers later is like, dude, I love that. Like, whatever that was, that the guys got fired up. And I'm like, well, let's do it again. And we turned that team around and ended up becoming a good playoff team. We didn't go super deep, but from where we were to where we ended up before I left, I'm really proud. And we had a great group of guys. The whole payroll for the team, if you can imagine this, I want to say it was $15 million for 20 guys. Okay. So we had all third line players trying to play first, second, third, fourth line because we couldn't get anybody because the league wouldn't make any moves because the guy Spano was in jail. There's a whole thing. Kevin Connelly, a great documentary on 30 for 30 on it. But that I was part of that whole deal. And I went from the penthouse in Vancouver, where we're eating steak and lobster on the plane, to going Southwest Airlines and the Dano Chara in a middle seat.
Did you hear Richie Pion? Richie Pion was there too? And,
no, he was gone. He was gone by that time. Oh, but okay. You know, we had Isbister, Cairns, Webb, Parrish. Yeah.
I remember that team. That was a tough team. I remember that. Yeah.
We actually did have a tough team, and we brawled the Rangers a lot. Like, I didn't know real rivalry until I went there, and I was like, and the fans just nuts. I couldn't believe it. Actually had a chance to sign a 4-year deal, the biggest contract ever in my life with the Rangers, and I screwed up. I should have taken it. But I had such a disdain for the Rangers because I didn't like any of the guys on their team, and they hadn't made the playoffs in 8 years. But Slats is, and you know, Gravy is like on the phone with me, and they're like, come on, you're going to be assistant captain. You're going to play on the second line. I'm just like, and I should have freaking taken it. But I went to Boston instead, and I got traded after like 2 months. And I was living across from Tom Brady. I was infiltrating the city. I was going to, we're set up. I just signed there so I could win a Stanley Cup. And I'm like, if I'm going to be somewhere 4 years, I want to like win a cup. And Milbury used to call me all the time for like trade advice. Like, he'd be like, what do you think about the player? And he'd be,
really? He did? Wow.
Like, he respected me a lot.
Wait, he was drunk when he called you? yeah, drunk Mafia like, for trade advice.
Yeah, and he's like, hey, like, you know, I'm, what, are you happy here? Do you want to stay? Do you know anybody that wants to go? Like, and I'm just like, listen, Mike, like, you know, you're the GM. He goes, well, I like this player for Atlanta. Do you like him? I'm like, I don't think he's your guy. And he's like, why? And he goes, I'm like, he's, watch, every single time he lets you get the puck first. Like, he doesn't want to take a hit to make a play. I don't want anybody on my team like that. And I go, just watch next game. Tell me if I'm wrong. And I was always right. The players kind of know. Like, you know when you go and you're eyeing somebody up and you're both going for the puck and they kind of let you have it?
Yeah.
That's not going to win you a cup, I don't think. Yeah. Anyways, totally. So Mike O'Connell from the Bruins calls me and he goes, hey, Sketch, we made a trade today. I'm like, oh, great. Who did we get? And they're like, David Tanabe from the Coyotes. I'm like, okay, cool. Who do we have to give up? And they're like, well, you. And you go, me? I said, you knew I could have signed 5 years with the Maple Leafs. I could have signed 4 years and $1 million more with the Rangers. I could have signed in Nashville. And I chose you guys to win a cup. And there was the only team that didn't offer me a no trade was Boston, but I was trying to win a cup. Right. And he just used me and abused me. And I was out there. He goes, listen, this is at 10 o'clock at night. He goes, you're playing at 7 p.m. tomorrow against the San Jose Sharks with the Phoenix Coyotes. So you got to go down to the Garden, get your gear, and you're on a 6 a.m. flight, and then you're going to land in San Francisco, take a limo from San Fran to San Jose, and then Gratz is going to meet you, and you're going to play that night. I'm like, oh, my God. So you know how it is when you get traded. You're running around. Like, I didn't sleep because I didn't want to miss my flight, and I'm so nervous, and I'm landing, and I'm exhausted and stressed out, and then same thing. Like, I got to fight somebody. I got to do something, you know, to show them. So I think it was Scott Thornton. Is that the guy from
San Jose? Yeah, he's a big dude. Yeah.
Big guy, tough guy, too. And
yeah.
I smoke somebody with a good, clean hit, and I turn around, his gloves were off, and he's just throwing bombs at me. And I didn't really, like, lose too many fights, but I lost that one. And luckily, I made up with it with a power play goal a little later. Like, okay, a goal in a fight, my first game. But I was just playing on pure adrenaline. I didn't sleep. Pre-game, I didn't sleep. At least I knew, like, Donner and Tyson Nash. Like Gretzky sitting there pregame meal when I walk in with all my bags and I'm like, hey guys, like, you know how this.
Had you met him before? Did you met him?
He was my biggest idol my whole life, man. Like, I idolized Wayne. So he was always good to me, but I didn't feel like he knew what kind of player I was. I really liked to shoot the puck, and we had a lot of guys on Phoenix who liked to shoot, but nobody liked to pass. So time here, he never really got to see me do what I wanted to do. And I didn't think I played that great, and I don't think that he knew how to use me. And like, Wayne was super nice to me, and I really respect him and appreciate him, but he didn't get to see me do my thing. And then I had my fourth concussion. I guess I'm fast forwarding through my whole career. I had my fourth concussion. My something's off. Like, I didn't feel like all the pain and all the messed upness that I did on my fifth big concussion, but something was off and I couldn't get my balance. Like, no matter what I did, saw every chiro in the world and nobody could help me. So Eric Lindros calls me from the PA and says, will you come work with the union as a divisional player rep? And I wasn't like, I didn't feel like I was retiring, but I just couldn't get better. And the Coyotes bought me out. We let them buy me out because I thought I'd get another job. And what I didn't know was they told everybody else in the league, I was
damaged goods.
So then when my agent starts calling around, they're like, oh no, Coyotes said he'll never play again. And then I'm like, oh man, that didn't work so well. Because we could have, saved $1 million.
You can't be bought out when you're injured, right? You're
correct. Yeah. Correct. And we were going to fight it. And then I'm like, well, league minimum's like 600 or something. So you can get me a 2-year deal, right? And he's like, oh yeah, somebody will sign you. But what we didn't know is the word on the street was this guy will never play again. So I go work with the union for 2 years. I find this weirdo doctor. Jeff Cortwell referred up to me, and his name is Dietrich Klinghart in Seattle. I go down there. This guy shoots like hundreds of shots, calls this thing a crown of thorns in my brain and in my skull, all these like needles. And he sticks balloons up my nose, pops out the front of my face, blood everywhere. Then he does these mega dosing of all these IVs for 3 days. I'm sitting there like 20 grand, and they're just doing all these radical treatments on me. At one point, he sticks this needle in the side of my temple, and I open up my jaw, and the needle just disappears. I'm like, where is it? Oh, jeez. It was a long needle. And then all of a sudden, I feel like this, like, felt like a hot water balloon's like spraying around in my brain. And then he adjusts my neck. And this is after 3 days of this. And I'm like, holy crap. Like, that's how I used to feel. And I got like Vans shoes on and shorts. And I walk out. I don't even go to my car. I go running. I just find this trail. I run and ran for 5 miles. I'm like, holy crap. I wonder if I could play again. And I hadn't done any workouts in a year and a half with the union when I was working for the union.
Yeah.
So then I go back home and I haven't told my wife yet, but I'm like, I want to see if I can play again. So I go and I tried to gather as much gear as I could in Vancouver. I go over to North Vancouver and I'd go to stick time. I could just with normal people get up. And I was the first one there. I put on my whole gear because I don't know if I'm going to fall and hurt myself. And I buy a puck because I didn't have any pucks. And I step on the ice at the entry gate at this end of the building. And the net was at the far end. I took a wrister. It just goes like, dink, off the crossbar and post and in, like the perfect shot.
Nice.
And I look up at the sky and I'm like, really? We're doing this? And then I went home and I told my wife, I said, I think I'm going to make a comeback. And camp was
what did you say?
She goes, were you kidding me? And I go, no. And she goes, I go, babe, I feel good. So I don't have an agent. I call Mike Gillis from the Canucks. I go, look, I'm in town. I'm not asked for a deal, but like, let me come to camp and show you what I can do. I need to know for myself. I went to camp, had an awesome camp. Had a goal and a fight in my first couple exhibition games. And my groins were just like guitar strings because I went from like 0 to Mach 10, and but I was playing good. And they wouldn't wait around to see. Like, I went right up to almost the last day, and they said, hey, listen, like, you can play, but we can't keep your eye to wait for you. But we'll send a fax around to the league and tell everybody you can play. And then Nashville reached out and said, listen, we love you. We want to sign you before. Would you do a two-way deal? I'm like, yeah, man, I just want to play hockey. I want to see if I can play hockey again. And they're like, okay, cool. And I scored 20 goals in 24 games or something like that in the minors. Like, I scored a goal a game. But they bring me up, and after 29 days, they'd send me down and bring another kid up. And they just rotated because at 30 days, they'd have to tell me to stay and get a play. So they just rotated me the whole year like that. And I got a wife, 3 kids in Milwaukee for the Admirals farm team. It was brutal.
And where's your wife from?
She's from Tennessee, actually. So she loved it that I signed with Nashville. Like,
stuck in Milwaukee is not very nice, though.
Yeah. Yeah. It. But, you know, the good guys there, Lane Lambert was the coach. He was great. Really respected me and listened. Like, I was almost like a third coach for that team. Yeah. But Nashville wouldn't give me one way the next year. And I was pissed because, like, I felt like I earned it. I had a MCL injury right near the end of the year that kind of set me back. But other than that, I had a fantastic year. And St. Louis called me and said, we'd like to sign you. And they gave me a decent two-way. I felt like I earned a one-way, but they told me I had a real shot to play on the team. And I thought they had a great team. They won the cup a couple years later, but they didn't really give me a real shot. They kind of wanted me to mentor their young guys in the minors. Yeah. So anyways, had the big injury after I got set down in the minors. And then it was all she wrote.
Yeah. How's your health now then? Are you back to 100%?
I just did my first Ironman last year, 140 miles. Yeah.
I guess you're back. Yeah.
I mean,
you have children, Dave?
Yeah. I got a 17-year-old daughter who's getting ready to go to college next year or 2 years from now. My 15-year-old boy and 14-year-old boy. So,
Do you think your relationship with your father has, I guess, in some ways helped your relationship with your kids?
In many ways. But also, I'm going to, because it was so hard. Like, it was so strict. I think this sort of society, actually, in a way, is my belief, is I think the pendulum has swung back so far the other way, and it's so loosey-goosey, and the standards aren't really there, and there's everybody's just okay with the participation medals, and it's very neutral. There's not really... There's a few kids out there who are just gung-ho and they're going for it. You can see it's a different kid. But, like, I'd say, like, the majority of our society, unfortunately, I feel is very neutral. And
there's not a lot of drive to go get things, right? Like to work hard.
And with AI and stuff like that, like there's, it's going to get, when I was doing stuff with Tony in 2013, 2014 or something like 14, 15, we brought in a futurist, Peter Diamandis, and he was showing us like robotics and AI back in 2015. And they were 3D printing tracheas and body parts with your own stem cells. And he's like, look, there'll be a day in the not too distant future where you'll have a whole closet that will just be your stuff. And you need a new lung, they just take one out and put one in that's made of your own stuff. Your body doesn't reject it. They say the problem in the future, because it's going to be so much AI, is that people will be bored. Like, what do? And you don't need to go make as much money because, let's say you need a surgery. Well, the robot's going to do the surgery. The robot can do the surgery at 4 a.m. It doesn't take any days off. It doesn't take maternity leave. It doesn't take anything. So, and it'll be more accurate than the human doctor. So in the future, costs will go down. So you don't have to make quite as much, but it's like, you're going to be bored because so much will be done for you that you're like creativity now. Like you don't even need creativity. You can just type in AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
Make me a photo or a video of this. And it does it. It's incredible. So, you know, I think purpose is going to be one of the most valuable resources for people moving forward and creating a sense of hunger to fulfill your purpose, I believe will create the happiness. I think if you're on purpose, it's not work. You can't wait to go do the thing.
Yeah.
But when you're lost, you're like, what am I supposed to do? Like,
yeah, I call it purpose, passion, and intent, right? Like you have to have a purpose, put your heart into it, do it the right way. Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, do you ever look at yourself now and think back to when you played the game and say, man, I can't even believe I'm talking the way I'm talking right now, right?
Oh, I can't believe I did the things I did. Like people send me fights, like I'm fighting Martin McSorley or Chris Simon, God rest his soul, or like any of these guys. And like, I'm like, what was I doing in that ring? Because I don't belong. And thank God I was big and strong because like I could always hang on if I started to get smoked, but like nobody taught me how to fight. I didn't take boxing lessons. I didn't even know, but if there was a line brawl and it was Donald Brashear, Troy Crowder, and Dave Scatcherd, who do you think everybody wants to grab? They want to grab me. Like, that was our fourth line in Vancouver briefly.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. So like, you know, I see Brash is still playing and fighting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. I don't know how he could do that. But I played with some of the toughest, like, and Marty came to one of my events last year and sat on the stage and I pulled up our fight and he's like, well, you know, you were a young kid and you just asked for a shot. I'm like, actually, Marty, that's not really how it went. And I did flip it. Or he's Jason Blake and he cross checks me.
Oh, that's funny.
Let's go.
That's pretty tough because one of his first games, I fought him too. Didn't know who he was.
Hell yeah.
That's probably like my third or fourth year in the league. I was still decently tough. Went at it pretty good. And every game after that, because, you know, he couldn't play at all when he first started. So he had to fight all the time. So every time we played against him after that, he goes, Laidlaw, let's go. Laidlaw, let's go. I finally turned to him. I said, I'm not keeping you in the league. I'm done with you.
Right.
But I give him credit, though. He worked hard to make himself a player.
Wayne says great things about Marty and how he turned himself into a player to be able to compete on that team. And Marty told an amazing story where he went into Slats' dressing room in playoffs. He said, look, you want me to be the leader of this team or call me a leader and you want me to go do this and fight every night? You can't,
Tony Robbins calling to that.
Yeah, exactly. I can't be a leader if you're sitting me out. And he goes, I want to play every game. And he said he played every playoff game after that. And
that right?
It's cool to have the balls to do that. Cause I was maybe too nice in my career. Like,
yeah. Yeah. You want to be that good team. You want to be that good team guy, right? Yeah.
I was all about the team and I put my, even on my first chance to get a big deal on my 4-year deal, I went to try to help a team win and take a third line position. And like, I never stuck up for myself the way that I wish I would have and known my value.
But at the same time though, Dave, don't you think that's why people respect you so much too in the game?
100%. And I think it kept me in the league at the beginning because I was the total consummate team player. I didn't ever bitch about ice time. I didn't ever bitch about somebody else getting a shot. I would just go do my work and I knew that those other people would leave and I would stay because of who I was and what I would bring to the table every day.
100%. Yeah, totally. I agree 100%. Well, listen, I had not known you before. You're a fascinating human being. Your story, the way you speak,
We're going to have you on again, though. One hour is not enough.
Listen, man, anytime you guys need me, I'm here. And when I get my pod fired up, I'll get you back.
One more time, the name of your book.
Yeah, the book is called The Comeback, My Journey Through Heaven and Hell. And
it's out now.
Yep, it's out. It can be found on Amazon. I sell it privately as well. You know, we do speaking. I've got coaching clients all over the world. We do a lot of virtual. We have group coaching. You know, this is what I do full time. This screen behind me, I normally have jerseys all behind me, but I was doing a big training yesterday for people. So that's why that.
Is that the name of your training company, All-Star Coaching?
All-Star Coaching, yeah. And
what's your website, Dave?
Yeah, allstarcoaching.com is the best place. And there's a little motivational piece on how to build a bulletproof mindset on there. We might be changing that out. I just put that up there temporarily. But if people want to go on there and check it out and get a little pump up and kind of get into the mind of, what's great, Tom, as you know, and probably with these interviews too, is you get to peek behind the curtain on a lot of cool people doing a lot of cool things and seeing what makes them tick. And what I've tried to do is grab all the common denominators from all these people and be like, look, even though this person's in finance and this person is an online entrepreneur and this one's a pro athlete, these are all common denominators amongst everybody. And this seems to be the pattern and the habits and the routines that seem to work for these people. So why wouldn't we want to like model them? You know, it's not rocket science. And sometimes it's one of my coaches calls it, you know, I still have coaches myself, but like one of my coaches calls it AIC, like sometimes it's just ass in chair, like sit down, put your ass in the chair and don't leave until the job's done. And people get so distracted. You got to turn on your little focus thing on your computer, right? You got to try your do not disturb and set a timer and say for the next 2 hours, I'm grinding. I'm going to get this thing done. And then when you do, you feel good and you can go celebrate and then you come back and keep working. But, you know, it's weird, man. I'm nervous for my kids growing up in this because they are getting buzzed, dinged 50,000 times a day. It's hard to keep your mind on track. So anyways, I just try to help people do that as I'm sure you do. And even sometimes a little boost of energy can help somebody see things a little differently or have a new perspective. And I think that that's one of the greatest gifts anybody could ever do for somebody else.
Yeah, is that. All right, so we're going to get you on Survivor, and
come on, Tom.
And with all the talking you and I do, we're going to do about 10 more podcasts. We've been talking forever. So.
All right. If you're ever bored, you need some filler.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. You and I can I wasn't that much of a talk. I did talk a lot in the locker room before, but now I can't shut up now. I go to events now, and I'm talking for hours. And
yeah, can confirm. Except on the phone.
Listen, what I've learned through one of my energy guys is like as an external, which means it's not like introverted, extroverted, but an external is the energetic flow that somebody gets. If you're a seeker and you like to like go see and do new things, you're probably an external because you're looking for answers in the field. And we get fed by the field. We get fed by conversation. We get fed by other people. And whenever we're low, we need to go out into the field. We need to broadcast like you're doing right now. So it's beautiful. You're doing the right thing. You're making a difference in people's lives. And I appreciate that.
You too, brother. You are a fantastic person. We are definitely having you on again. All right. Now, I want to watch you at CBS at 8:00 on Wednesday night, walking around in your underwear.
That'd be amazing.
There you go. All right, brother. Great to see you. Good to meet you.
Thanks, Dave. Have a good day, guys.
Hey, Tom, that was great. I mean, wow, what a story. What a story.
He started talking. And I never met him before. And the way he was talking, the story he went through and tell us all stuff, he's a fantastic human being, man.
Oh, my God, yeah. And he said, the big thing he said was perspective shift to change his life. But he's like you in that he's all positive and he's very grateful. And, you know, you purposely done that in your life. You're like, you know what, I'm going to just always be positive and I'm going to be grateful and thankful, you know, tell people I care, tell people... Yeah. I'm glad you're in my life. That type of stuff, because that vibrates at a higher level than, you know, the negativity, for sure.
Amazing. You're right, right? And thank you for saying that, because it means a lot to me, because I go up in the world now, you know, say something nice. You got to be careful about women, obviously, but, you know, you see a nice, like an older woman or whatever, you say, man, yeah, beautiful. You got a great smile.
Like, it really makes a difference in their worlds. And
so yeah, you're putting this positivity out there and it's coming back to you and to other people. That's awesome.
Totally. And I never knew that before. I couldn't figure that out. Like, now it just seems so simple. Like, why didn't I get that before? And maybe I was still okay with people. I mean, I was nice to them, but I wasn't going out of my way to make them feel good. And you're like that too. You're very positive.
Well, thank you. But I think it's, I don't know, it's energy, frequency, vibration. I don't know enough about it yet, but I do know about energy. And positive energy is infectious. You know that. You know you know that when someone's got bad energy, you're like, I don't really want to deal with this guy.
I know. Is that true? And I think I'm more aware of that now, that I don't allow that bad energy into my life. I'm not mean about it. I'm not mad at people. But if somebody's got that bad energy, I move on.
No, like Dave right there. Like Dave Scatcherd, you don't want to be around him because it's just positivity just flowing out of him, you know? And it's like, it was genuine.
I know I've talked about this before. I love those shows when I don't know the guy. Yep. I've just seen him from a distance. And he was pleasantly surprised with him. Like, his personality is just incredible.
What a great episode, great story. And he was emotional and grateful, which was amazing. Yeah. You know, he said he was grateful to all the hard work that he had done to get to the NHL and choked him up. And that,
you know, when he got emotional like that, like, I'm still going to have to work on that a little bit, where if I get emotional, I still try to fight it. Like, he was good at just letting it go. He got emotional. I tried to hold him back a little bit, but he basically let it go. So that was
one. You know what, though? But you know, yeah, absolutely one of our best shows. But who gives a fuck? So be emotional. Who cares? You know, we're not in third grade where people are going to say, did you see that Tommy was crying? You know,
I guess it's
still not shit.
You know what it is? It's interesting.
It's hard.
About this. Yeah. I think that, not like Dave, my family was. Beautiful family, but it was no crying. There was no hugging. There was no telling I love you. So I never cried at all. Like, my grandmother died, I never cried. My grandfather died, I never cried. My uncle died, I never cried. And it was interesting. I got back to the Hall of Fame, my hometown of Brampton, and my mother was dying of cancer at the time. So, you know, you go up and you thank your family and everybody else. So I started thinking about my mother, and I just lost it. I was like, right in front of 200 people at this award ceremony. I think because I'd held it in for so long, when I finally just couldn't hold it anymore, and just like, oh man, it was sob mess.
Yeah,
and I know most people looking at me didn't know what's going on, but you know, it was all the thanking for your mother and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, she was one of the people, again, very fantastic mother, but she wanted me to hold in the tears. She didn't want her son crying all the time.
But think about that though. Back to energy, like, that's energy. You have to release energy through that emotion.
Yeah.
You have to get rid of it, because it'll turn into stress or something worse internally. You know, so. You have to get that out. It's good that you did. And we definitely need to do that more. But then, like Dave said, you don't want to be people like, oh, what a pussy. You know, look at him crying.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny? Like, look at Mark Messier. Like, he's...
Yes. He cries all the time.
Yeah. Nobody puts him as a pussy, right? I mean, he's...
Right. They're like, listen, he showed his emotion. That's strength. Yeah. You know, it's strength to have that courage, you know?
Remember, did you ever see his speech when he got inducted into the Hall of Fame? It was longer than it's supposed to be speech, but it must have been an hour. I think he cried the whole time during the speech.
He couldn't get through it. Listen, but good for him. Ooh, I remember Mike Schmidt did that, and Howard Stern ran with it forever. Like, he kept playing the clip of him crying about getting into the Hall of Fame, you know? You know, it was stupid, but it's like, at least when you are able to show that and have that fearlessness, that's awesome, man. I wish I had that.
Yeah, you know, I think, like, again, Mark Messier is a good example. He lived his life in a whole way that everybody said, well, he's not a baby, he's not some wussy guy. He just gets, he cries all the time. He's still Mark Messier, right?
Yeah, and they say he wears his emotions on his sleeve. They say it's almost like a you know, a badge of honor, you know, and that's how it should be, because that's what life is. And you know what? We live, we were born, we live, we die. So who cares what other people think, you know? And that's so hard to get rid of, but
we worry about so much stuff. I've told a story before. When I got in the agent business, I had I'm still kind of living that hockey player life, like drinking beer every night.
Yeah.
And the players started calling me at night, and I think, geez, mumbling? I can't remember what they said. So it really scared me. And I didn't intend to, but I stopped drinking for 5 years. And one of my biggest concerns, and this is strange to say this, but the truth, is what are people going to think of me because I'm not drinking? And I look back, like, why was I worried about what everybody else thought about me?
Right.
And nobody cared anyways. Like, it was the weirdest thought process for me, but it's...
Well, who cares? Just you know, put out that positivity, be a good person, you know, spread that around, and the gratitude. And that's, Dave clearly does that, and he did that, and you know, it's infectious.
Oh, man, he got going. I realized, wow, what a human being he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool.
So that was awesome, man. Great show. So, and if you like it, you know, leave us a message, share. Apple reviews are great for us. Leave us a 5-star review, share the podcast, go on social media, and enjoy Full Change Podcast.
Yeah, enjoyed that.
All right, Grasshoppers, thank you for listening. We had a fantastic show. We'll see you next time. We'll
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.